Today on Off Mic, Gary native Clifford Johnson has been nominated to become the next U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Indiana. We talk about what his selection may mean and talk to two people who know him well. And if COVID infections are going up, why then aren't more people getting vaccinated? We talk to two ladies who are trying to boost vaccination rates in Northwest Indiana. And there's continued unrest in Cuba. We talk to someone who knows the country well and gives us his thoughts on what he thinks the U.S.'s role should be in resolving this. All this on Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Northwest Indiana could soon be getting a new U.S. attorney. Gary native Clifford Johnson was nominated earlier this week by President Joe Biden to be the new United States attorney for the Northern District of Indiana. Biden also nominated Zachary Myers, also an African-American, to become the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Indiana. Indiana has never had African-Americans serve as U.S. attorneys for either district. In this segment, we'll focus more on Johnson, since the Northern District includes the northern half of Indiana, from the Illinois state line to the Ohio border. Major cities in the district include Gary, Hammond, South Bend, Fort Wayne, and Lafayette. Johnson has a long history serving in the federal system. He was the assistant U.S. attorney for the Northern District from 1986 to 2020. Before that, he was a trial attorney in the employment litigation section in the Civil Rights Division for the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. Johnson received his law degree from Valparaiso University in 1980. If confirmed by the U.S. Senate, Johnson would replace former U.S. attorney Thomas Kirsch, who is now a United States Circuit Court judge in the Seventh Circuit. Kirsch got to the Seventh Circuit by replacing Amy Coney Barrett, who left to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. Gary Mayor Jerome Prince offered these words about Johnson's nomination.
You know, have a sense of pride, to be completely frank with you, that a local Gary native was nominated by President Biden, and we certainly, given the opportunity, would extend that excitement to President Biden as well. Here locally, I'm certain that the opinion and the sentiments will be echoed across the board. Clifford's a great guy. I know him personally, and I'm certain that everyone who's in my generation and those even a little bit older than me are familiar with him. Personally speaking, I think he's done an excellent job in the U.S. Attorney's Office as the assistant. And, you know, what we certainly need these days and always in government is persons who we have the confidence that they will lead with the level of integrity that's expected of elected officials or appointed officials in this case. And in this instance, Clifford will absolutely rise to that level as well.
What do you think his experience, not just in terms of being a career federal deputy prosecutor, but growing up in a city like Gary, understanding the nuances of urban living, and do you think any of his background will play into how he may serve as a U.S. attorney?
Well, I'm hoping that it will, and I'm fairly certain that it will. You know, as officials, certainly I can speak from a personal perspective, we draw on all of our experiences to do the very best job that we can at whatever assignment that we're afforded the opportunity to facilitate. And in this instance, certainly that's a very important role. Not only for the folks of Gary, but for everyone. It's important that folks in our judicial system be of the type of integrity and caliber of character that Clifford represents. And to that extent, I believe it's a win-win for everyone.
I also asked longtime Lake County prosecutor Bernard Carter.
He's been assistant U.S. attorney, chief assistant U.S. attorney, under Dave Capp. He was interim during to men. I believe he's been in the criminal justice system for probably about 35 to 40 years on the federal level. So a man that knows the job, a man who's capable of doing the job, he is that person.
Well, Bernie, let me ask you this. So if Clifford Johnson becomes, if he gets confirmed through the Senate, he would become the first African-American to hold that position as U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Indiana. You made history almost 30 years ago by becoming the first African-American prosecutor for Lake County, Indiana. How has your background, your experience, your upbringing in an urban area, how, if anything, how can you relate that to your work as a prosecutor?
Well, I think there's two purposes of my having this position. One is obviously to follow the state law and abide by the state law in terms of the administration of this office. And I think we try to do that with the people who work here and certainly myself from an ethical standpoint as well as doing the right thing. The second part is as far as being elected by the citizens of Lake County and over the years I have been elected, I think I use that as a tool to speak, a tool to go out and talk with young African-Americans, not only young African-Americans, but just young people in general. About you can do anything you put your mind to if you just try and you prepare yourself to be in a position when that opening comes up that you be qualified for it. So I use it as I hope people, and I've had students over the years and people over the years say, you know, I heard about you, I admired you, and this is what caused me to go into law enforcement. This is what caused me to be a lawyer today. I've had a number of individuals have addressed me in that manner. And I think that's the goal. The goal is to be an example for our community. The goal is to set options for young African-Americans, young people of color, whether you're Mexican or African American, whether you're white, just to make an example of you may not have that community backing that you should have, or you may be in a situation where you need to improve your station in life. You can do it, and I kind of work off that aspect of it, and it's received pretty well.
Absolutely, absolutely, and so you're definitely in the group that hopes that the Senate, I mean, it's still going to be a tough fight to for the Senate to confirm him just because of that party line vote. But you think he would be a perfect candidate for that job?
Yeah, I absolutely do. Very much so. You know, from every aspect, from his, as I mentioned, from his knowledge of what he's been doing, what was capable of being done over there in the U.S. Attorney's Office, as well as it does send a very strong message to all communities that the milestone that he will accomplish by being the very first African American in that position is an honor for our entire African American community.
The confirmation process could take a long time with no firm date as to when any hearings will take place. And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. You know, I think we've seen this movie before. COVID numbers are starting to go back up in many parts of the United States due to the Delta variant, and that includes Northwest Indiana. Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb will hold a press conference about the issue later today. Experts say part of the problem is that not enough people are getting vaccinated. And that's especially true in East Chicago, where only 36% of the population have gotten the vaccine, way below the statewide rate of 53%. Well, two ladies are trying to do something about it, and I had a chance to catch up with them recently about their door-to-door efforts to get more folks in East Chicago vaccinated. All right, ladies, just say your name for me.
Sarah Ferraro.
And?
Elizabeth Palacio.
All right. So you're telling me that you are going around canvassing in the city of East Chicago
to get the vaccination rate up. What is it right now?
Correct. So it's around 35% in East Chicago. You can actually, the state has put out the zip code data, so you can go on the state website and see what all the zip codes are. So we're focusing on some of the lower vaccinated areas, talking to folks about what their hesitancies are to get that up.
Elizabeth, what do you think the hesitancies are?
Just not knowing and scared and knowing if they need any, the type of ID that they might need. I think our city needs to be reassured of the information that's out there, and we can give it to them.
East Chicago has a large Latino population, maybe undocumented. Do you think that's some of the problem?
It could be, yes. And as far as a close-knit community, I believe that's part of the problem. And also, that is a part of the problem.
So what's entailed with this canvassing?
So we've been going door-to-door, and Elizabeth's one of our top people because she knows her area and knows her neighbors so well. She's working with other volunteers with Rise Northwest Indiana, which is a program through the Legacy Foundation, and kind of guiding them. And because she's helps us with Spanish speaking, we can talk to everybody and kind of talk about their fears and ask them questions and just hear what they need so that we can jump over those hurdles.
Also, East Chicago has a large working class community. People working, what, one, two, three, who knows how many jobs. You think maybe just getting vaccinated is on the lower end of the priority list for them?
It could be, yes. Uh-huh. And then, with that, then we have to get that job amount up like $15, $16 an hour, but that's another subject.
Well, any speculation, Sarah, on like just why people are just slow to it, especially Chicago? Got hit pretty hard with COVID.
It did. A lot of things we've been hearing, just lack of information, nervous about how fast they thought the vaccine came out. So that's helping us to have those one-on-one conversations and knowing what we can help either bring to the community education-wise, help the health department here if our organization or Legacy can bring them other resources. So just having those conversations is really opening the door to that first step.
And the state, I know they've been having a lot of free vaccination clinics and everything. Did the state need to do more?
I think so. And they've offered, we worked on one in Wolf Lake, and they said, just let us know and we'll come back and we'll do these other mobile pop-up sites. So I think that's something that probably should be on the horizon.
So tell me about the canvassing. What does it entail? Just spend all day going out to places?
Yes, walking up and downstairs and visiting our neighbors. It's a lot of fun. It helps us interact with them and help give them confidence of who we are at Purple Shirts walking towards them. We want them to know.
So don't be scared.
No, don't be scared.
All right, ladies, anything else that I didn't ask that you'd like to get across, something I failed to ask?
I don't think so, but if you'd like to join us, we are more than happy to have new volunteers. We actually had people reach out to us from Hammond, so we're going to get a group trained up in Hammond. Just come and join us, because the more the merrier, and you know your community best. I mean, that's why Elizabeth's the expert, and I just tag along. And she knows everyone and knows their story, and we can just start right there, and we have great conversations.
So if somebody wanted to volunteer with this, where would they get information?
So we have a Facebook page, Rise NWI. We're also on Twitter and Instagram, or you can email us at contact@risenwi.org.
Fabulous work.
All right, ladies, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. That song is Cuba Libre by the Cuban-American singer Gloria Estefan. Cuba is on the minds of many Americans these days as we continue to see unrest on the island nation just 90 miles off the Florida coast. There have been protests against the communist government due to rising inflation, a lack of food, power outages, and increasing COVID-19 deaths. Cuba has also tried to clamp down on the protests, with the Biden administration sending a stern warning to Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel. Díaz-Canel took over for Raúl Castro in 2019. Of course, Fidel Castro led the country from 1976 to 2008. President Biden has also issued new sanctions against Cuba for its hardline stance against its own people. Joining me to talk about the latest on the island nation and what should be America's role in dealing with Cuba is Hugo Chaviano. Hugo is a longtime attorney in Chicago. He is past president of the Hispanic National Bar Association and served as secretary general for the Inter-American Bar Association. He also served as director of the Illinois Department of Labor under Governor Bruce Rauner. He is also a native of Cuba, leaving the country when he was just 13 years old. Hugo Chaviano, it is such a pleasure for me to have you join us today on Off Mic. So welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I was already very inspired about this segment by listening to the opening song.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Hugo, when you see the TV on there, and of course you're a native of there, and I know you visited as an adult, and you have a very interesting history with the Cuban nation. When you see the unrest in Cuba, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
It certainly breaks my heart to see, the Cuban people being completely abused and beaten for really asking for the most basic of rights, which is, liberty and freedom, things that we in this country take for granted, the right to free speech, the right to dissent, the right to have just a different opinion.
When you're hearing talking to fellow expatriates who are Cuban Americans living in this country who are native of Cuba, what is the overall feeling? How should the United States be dealing with Cuba right now?
Well, I think for many, is this going to be just one more instance where, the Cuban people have tried to rise only to be crushed by a system that, completely controls every aspect of their lives. And once, the news dies down, life goes on. I think that there are certain things right now that are different from what we have seen in the past, and that is the role that the internet has played in bringing together these people, and most importantly for others in the island to learn that they were fellow Cubans who have the same grievances, that have the same angst and desire for for freedom. And that in itself leading to the unprecedented spread of these, demonstrations, which started on Sunday, July the 11th in San Antonio de los Baños, which is, sort of in American lingo, a town or a suburb, from about 20 minutes from Havana.
Mm-hmm. After years of just decades of sanctions by the United States, just sort of pretty much closing off diplomatic relations, under President Obama, he reopened diplomatic relations with Cuba, which allowed more Americans to visit the nation at the time. Then the Trump administration took a harder line stance against Cuba, broke off diplomatic relations and cut off travel there. Now, it also seems though now President Biden is kind of sort of following the Trump administration and taking a hardline stance. Should the United States have done that sort of? It seems like with so much American money and influence that by now had those level that sort of the diplomatic channels would have slowly but surely eroded that communist country.
I was an early supporter of the embargo. I also looked positively when during the Clinton years and so forth, some of those restrictions were hardened. Proceeding with the Helms-Burton law and so forth. In my experience, when I first returned to Cuba, almost 40 years after leaving by myself at the age of 13, what I found in Cuba is that the embargo that we all had hoped and the sanctions we all had hoped would really lead to the ultimate crumbling of a regime that many wonder how it was able to maintain itself given the collapse of the Cuban economy and so forth, still continued to keep its complete hold over the government and the Cuban people. And most curious to me was the fact that the people in high government positions, the people who were part of the government elite, that privileged class that today is comprised by the army and such in Cuba, they had complete access to all these things that the embargo was trying to keep out of Cuba. And you saw two almost sort of parallel economies and lives that were taking place. One, the life that was being able to be led by those who had access to dollars and, hard currency, and that of the, average Cuban people, the people that in communist lingo they call the proletariat, who, could not access those dollar-only stores, could not access the hotels and other tourist venues that were accessed by only foreigners and or this select group of the government elite. So that led me to believe that maybe we needed to rethink the whole embargo situation and maybe engagement would be more effective, because one of the things that I saw also in Cuba was a dearth of information from the outside world. Of course, this was, preceded the blowout and explosion of the internet, globally. So because of that, I thought that, well, maybe engagement, maybe travel, more travel to Cuba, more exposure by the Cuban people to the outside, that may bring about a change. But, the reality has remained that the Cuban government hold over the Cuban people has never changed. And President Obama, in his initiative, which I would say, I have to say I supported at the time, which was the reestablishment of diplomatic relations in the hope that that engagement would lead to this, opening and more flexibility on the part of the Cuban government, never had those results. All the Cuban government was interested in return was the economic benefits that opening would bring, and hopefully ultimately the lifting of the embargo. So I think in light of what that turned out to be, President Biden's rethinking of that whole relationship is very much warranted.
Right. Before we get a little bit into the whole weeds and everything, let's talk a little bit about your personal journey from Cuba. Obviously, I've known Hugo Chaviano for a long time now. I know he's writing a book, but tell us a little bit about your early life in Cuba and what was it like?
Well, even though left Cuba at a very early age, I did have and retained very vivid memories of what was happening in Cuba in terms of the revolution, the excitement that was felt in Havana and the country at large in at the end of 1958, but the 1959 as Fidel and the caravan that started in Santiago de Cuba, at the other opposite end of the island from Havana, started to make its way towards, you know, towards Havana. And, you know, the outpouring of support, the outpouring of emotion and hope for what this new, you know, this revolution and Fidel would bring to Cuba in terms of, you know, democratic elections, you know, getting away from corrupt government and so forth. So I vividly witnessed that. And not only that, I was not in Havana at the time. I was in Palma Soriano, a city that is on the way to Havana on the province of Oriente. And Fidel spent, you know, the night there on his way at a house of a family, the Martinez Espinosa family, who was a very close friend with my family. And their grandson, you know, was a best friend of mine at the time. So, again, I have very vivid memories of that. But then I also witnessed how quickly things began to change once Castro got to Havana and started establishing himself in power. You know, one of the first things is that, you know, within a period of, you know, less than a year, the government, the provisional government that had been installed to, you know, set the stage for, you know, free elections and the like, was gotten rid of. Fidel emerged as the absolute and maximum leader. And he actually, they used actually that term, máximo líder de la revolución, maximum leader of the revolution. And you could see right away how the consolidation of power started to happen. The other thing is that concurrent with Fidel's arrival in Havana, you almost had a kind of a state of terror that began to happen. Che Guevara, who at the time one of the leading commanders of the revolution and was put in charge of La Cabaña, which is a major fortress at the entrance of Havana Bay in Cuba, started summarily executing hundreds of people that had been in prison, accused of either being Batista government collaborators and or counter-revolutionaries. And that whole wave of executions kind of spilled over to other parts of the island, and the common cry at the time became Paredón, Paredón meaning up against the wall. And it would really take nothing but, you know, an accusation for you to all of a sudden, you know, find yourself in the crosshairs of the new regime, and you could either be executed, you could be sent to prison for long terms, or you may just be given, you know, slap in the hand, but it became very arbitrary. So mm-hmm. that in itself quickly began to set an atmosphere of fear and suspicion amongst the populace. And that was also quickly followed what became known as the Committee of Defense of the Revolution, which basically was you know, a committee of your neighbors next door. You know, if you were living in the city, in every city block, and if you lived in a suburban setting, you know, in your, you know, the general neighborhood that you lived, and what your neighbors were charged with was spying, snooping, and knowing who was coming in and out of your house, what were, you know, who were your friends. What you had in your house, and so forth. So all this, you know, led to a feeling that if you were going to talk, you have to be very suspicious of who you were going to be speaking to. And then I remember how all of a sudden we all were talking in hushed tones because we did not want anybody, you know, to overhear what, you know, was going on, what was being conversed about. So it was a very, very quick evolution that I started to see. And then that was being then complemented with the confiscation of private property, which almost all these things were just happening almost sort of in tandem.
And then you found yourself at some point when you're 13 years old deciding whether to stay with your family on the country or leave or be recruited into its military, and then you'll be stuck there to what, 21 or 22, something like that?
Right. So, you know, by 1965, there is a new law that's passed where males, it was only directed to males, 15 years or older, could not leave the country until they were 27 years old. So that in itself created a sort of a, you know, an impetus for me to really think about, you know, what my future in Cuba would look like if I were to stay. You know, my father at the time could not get out of the country. And I had had the experience of a friend whose parents, you know, did not want to leave, had decided to stay. The political situation for the father changed. And all of a sudden, they had to leave. And by then, my friend was already 15, could not leave, and the family actually had to leave and leave him behind.
Wow.
And that had a major impact on me. So that really led to my talking to my parents about being allowed to leave the country. And that was a process at the time, because then the only way to get out of Cuba was either through Spain or Mexico. The bridge with the United States, you know, had been shut down.
Right.
And I ultimately, my parents agreed to support my departure. That's not to compromise my parents. I left under the pretense that I was going to be going to seminary school. I had gone to a Jesuit school in Cuba, and so I was going to go to seminary school in Spain. And then ultimately went to Spain, from where I then ultimately came to the United States and lived with relatives until my parents were able to migrate some years later.
Hugo, we only got a few more minutes. Let me ask you this. Starting tomorrow in the next couple of days, there's going to be protests around the United States for those who say they support the Cuban Revolution and demand an end to the U.S. blockade of the country. How do you feel about those protests? Is that the proper role, or is the United States being villainized over this?
Well, I think that's the beauty of our country. You know, obviously I feel very Cuban, but I feel also very American. And that's the beauty of our country, you know, the right to have a difference of opinion. I think it is not unusual for the Cuban government to have, you know, its display of people that will readily take to the streets to really defend and you know, and advocate on behalf of what's indefensible. In my mind right now, I think that the most important thing for us to do, and what I am actually proactively working on, because I'm working on the establishment of an organization that wants to support those who are advocating on behalf of global access of the internet by in Cuba, is to work, in unison towards being able to do that. And today we have the technology for being able to provide that to Cuba. And if the Biden administration were to get behind supporting that kind of initiative. And that's what I'm working on as we speak, and would like to lobby on behalf before the administration and other, you know, entities for support.
Well, Hugo Chaviano is a longtime attorney in Chicago. He's the former past president of the Hispanic National Bar Association and a Cuban American. Hugo, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Our first segment is going to sound something like a TV crime drama. Okay, so we all know how nifty cell phones can be. They aren't merely a phone, however. They are mini computers. They store a lot of data from photos, videos, games, and apps that can add to our lives or use for more sinister things. More often than not, the data in your phone can provide clues or downright evidence in solving crimes. And a new law in Indiana that started earlier this month aims to help prosecutors in the collection of that evidence. Joining me to talk about this new law and a few others is one of the longest-serving elected county prosecutors, not just in Indiana, but the nation, Lake County Prosecutor Bernard Carter. Welcome to Off Mic, Bernie.
Hey, bye, Mike. How are you?
All right. Okay, Bernie, well, we wanted to talk to you a little bit about the some of the new laws that are kicking in. One of them is HEA 1082. That involves high-tech crimes. What can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, the Senate and the House of Representatives passed a bill that essentially allows IPAC, that's Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Association, to establish 10 high-tech crime units throughout the state. And it's controlled and operated by each elected prosecutor in those 10 locations. So what's going on now is they're taking applications, and each entity that or county that's interested in it is starting to put together a package, a proposal, so they could be one of the 10. Here in Lake County, we obviously think that we certainly deserve one of those units, and we've been in the process now of putting together a very detailed proposal asking for one of those units. Essentially, what the units will encompass, you're talking about $600,000 for 2 years to get it established, and then it's further further funding down the line. But the first 2 years, the allocation is $600,000 for each unit. The unit consists of an association with one of the universities in your community. And in this case, we have came to an agreement as of yesterday with Purdue University. The chancellor there was very encouraged by the program. He thought it would be a great idea for his students as well as his university, and we equally feel the same way. They're going to be providing housing for us, office space, furniture, the phone system. They have a secured location that they're going to be able to put us in. So, because one of the things that the high-tech unit has to have, it has to be in a secure building. With a lot of firewalls and protections and things of that nature, and they have an excellent location there waiting to be used. So we're going to just kind of step right into that. So that's going to help our proposal, I think, a great deal. But essentially what this high-tech crime unit will do is it will go to the crime scene of any type of crime that they think that they will be able to get computers, cell phones, cameras, any kind of technology device that could record something. This unit would go in, secure it, maintain it, analyze it, and have it prepared for the prosecutors to prosecute cases using that information. You know, one of the interesting things about the high-tech crime unit is this. Just about every crime that is committed now, almost every crime, I don't care what it could be. It could be a child molesting. It could be auto theft. It could be murder. It could be rape. The person who is committing that crime has in their possession a cell phone. Nowadays, a cell phone is a computer, it's a camera, it encompasses everything. You can order anything off of a cell phone. You can communicate with a co-defendant or a cohort in an effort to in criminal enterprise. So we go in and grab the cell phones, we can get a whole history of what this person's been up to in the last 2 or 3 weeks, who they communicated with, who called in to them, who they called into, who texted them, who sent them photographs or pictures. So it's just amazing now how cell phones in particular is playing a part in criminal prosecution.
All right, Bernie, we'll move on a little bit because there's another interesting law that has come into effect on July 1st, which is very interesting to me. And a lot of people might think, well, we've been hearing about this, but it's about the theft of catalytic converters, which has been something that has been going on for, it seems like, years. What is this new law that's going to give you sort of new tools to combat this?
Well, one of the things that they're trying to do is, as you mentioned, it's extremely expensive, very expensive, the catalytic converter itself, to buy, to rebuy. If it's stolen from a car owner, many times the insurance won't cover it, so they have to pay for it themselves. And it could be several thousand dollars with installation. Also, one of the things we know is when they steal the catalytic converters, now what they're using these skill saws, and they battery-operated 18, 24-volt batteries, and they just go up underneath the car, roll under there, and just cut it out. And they ruin the whole muffler system, the whole exhaust system. So many times that entire system has to be replaced. So legislators understand that, and they're basically putting an additional sentencing range on these here. And they're making it where it could be a level 6 or level 5. A level 6 is kind of similar to old days of a Class D felony. Level 5 is probably like a Class C or B felony, whereas the jail time is increased drastically for that violation. In addition to it, they're making it the person who purchased it, the junkyard or whatever, they're increasing the penalty on that. So they're trying to put pressure on them not to be buying these from the individual, because if there's no purchaser, then there's no demand. There's no demand, and they're not going to be crawling underneath your car taking your catalytic converter because it has no value. But it has value, obviously, now because they can resell it on the market for a very good, a price. And it's very dangerous for the homeowner. It's very dangerous for the person who's removing it because, we've had situations where people look out their window, saw somebody, I remember a case in particular, saw somebody trying to carjack, take the car basically, and he shot the assailant and killed him. So that's not good for society. It ended up being a 16-year-old kid trying to steal a car. So taking these people catalytic converters and things of that nature certainly is a concern for all of us in our community.
It is interesting that people are still trying to, because I've been hearing about thefts of catalytic converters for several decades now, and it's a very maybe are unaware, but it's a very important part. It's legally required that you have one to reduce toxic emissions, pollutions, basically, from the environment.
That's correct. And when it's removed from your car, basically, you have to put another one back on there to stay within the legal guidelines. So it's not something that you can't. Once that catalytic converter is taken off that car, you can't run that car. You can't operate that car. It's very loud. So you have to either bypass it and put another pipe in there, and that's illegal, or you have to go and purchase another one. And you have to, here in Lake County, you have to pass the emission standards too. So no way you would pass the emission standards without a catalytic converter.
Couple of other things that have come out, and this is probably a big one for you, Bernie, is sentencing as it relates to drug dealers, that it's closing a loophole that I guess drug users have been using for several years. Do you know anything about that one?
Yeah, I sure do, because I was on the committee, was kind of pushing that through the state, and it was a concern to me because, I'm a real big believer, and Mike, you know me over the years, in second chances. I really promote that. I do it in our plea agreements. I try to get young people. I don't want to give a young person a felony conviction if we can avoid it. If there's no personal injury, there's no injury to the community, it's a theft or something that doesn't involve injury to a person or a human being in any capacity, I'm always willing to give a second chance and say hopefully this young man won't come back and learn his lesson with a misdemeanor as opposed to a felony. However, we have those who do get felony convictions and they continue to do criminal acts and they continue to come before the court. And for whatever reason, the court suspends their sentence and give them probation once again. And what this law basically says, if you're charged with a drug transaction and you plead guilty or you're found guilty and you get probation and you come back, within 10 years, I think it is, but it's within the limit. Well, it'll probably follow, but our application will probably be within 10 years, but I think it's indefinite. But if you come back before the court and you get charged with the same offense again, this is for repeat offenders, then the judge has no option but to send you to the Department of Corrections and have to sentence you within that sentencing guideline, whatever the term of the sentence of that charge is. But the judge cannot give you probation, cannot send you to work release, cannot give you alternative sentencing. And what we're trying to be is send the message that once is enough. Twice is obviously too many. And certainly the third time, you should be going to jail. In this change, the second time, you will be going to jail on a conviction.
We're talking to Bernard Carter, longtime prosecutor for Lake County, Indiana, about the new laws that have gone into effect this month that aids in criminal prosecutions. Bernie, I do have to ask you about a high-profile police-involved shooting out of Gary back in November 2019. A Gary police officer responded to a report of an intoxicated man with a weapon at an apartment on Roosevelt Street in Gary. Investigators said they found 82-year-old Melvin Bowler with a gun. He was also intoxicated and threatened to use the gun to harm himself and others. The officer from Gary responded, said Bowler was sitting in a car outside the complex when he pulled out a silver revolver from his right pocket and pointed it at the officer. The officer fired. Bowler was struck several times and critically wounded. Authorities said they recovered a loaded weapon from inside his red Nissan Altima. He died 2 months later. And just yesterday, a grand jury decided not to bring criminal charges against the officer. Prosecutor Bernard Carter, what can you tell us about that decision?
Yeah, I can say this, and I can say what I said at the press conference. Okay. I'm prohibited by state statute. It's 3534-10-2 that says that essentially that it's improper for a prosecutor to speak on testimonial evidence in a grand jury setting. So what we did a press release, and we allowed the sheriff to send to read a 15-page summary of their investigation as to this crime or alleged act.
All right.
At the press conference, I announced that the grand jury today, approximately 10 a.m., returned a no indictment verdict. So essentially, they did not bring any charges against this police officer. We had submitted charges for murder, and we submitted charges for reckless homicide to the grand jury. And in that return, they found no evidence to amount to that. And I announced that this morning.
All right. And this isn't something where you would charge Gary police officer Brandon Henderson on your own.
That's correct. Well, it went to a grand jury. So once it goes to a grand jury, then they hear the evidence and they make that decision. I had the right as a prosecutor not to take it to a grand jury and make that decision myself through my office. But we decided based on the evidence and based on what was presented, we wanted a full view heard by an entity such as a grand jury and let them make a determination.
Well, Bernie, let me ask you this, just in a broader sense. We've been, you know, obviously we hear a lot about police-involved shootings, especially when it comes to African-Americans. This is something that it people sometimes will, like, think that, you know, prosecutors and police are on the same side, but you are also there to protect the public, and you're also African-American. Do you feel generally that the courts give or the police? Let me ask you this. How do you feel in terms of overall, can African-Americans and minorities, is there enough justice in the justice system for people of color?
Well, that's a tough question, and it's a difficult question in light of the fact that it's been going on across our country. And you'd be blind, or I would be blind not to say that there's a problem there, and there is a problem there. But one of the things I clearly know is that in policing, you have some very good police officers, and police officers who go on duty to do the public's work. They're there and to protect us. You do have those who don't have the public interest in mind, and they out of control. Those individuals, one, should not be on the police force. Two, if they are alleged to have committed some act like that or did something like that, they should be charged, criminally charged. They should be fired, and they certainly should be prosecuted, and they should be incarcerated. I'm very strong on that issue. I'm also understand that the public don't trust the relationship between the prosecutor in a local jurisdiction and the police department in the same jurisdiction that they work with every day. And that's a problem. And I'm working with Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Association. I'm on one of the committees that's taking a real hard look at, and we're going to do something about this, where if a homicide or a shooting occurs where a police officer is involved and it results in a death, that case automatically is shifted to the state police for investigation. Secondly, it's shifted to an outside prosecutor coming in to review that case. The local prosecutor would not have any jurisdiction over that case. It would be given by a local outside prosecutor to come in and prosecute that case, similar to what they did up in Minnesota. Now, I think that's very important because the nexus between a local prosecutor and the current police departments in that jurisdiction is a very close nexus. But I do know prosecutors take their job very seriously, and they will prosecute, such as myself. I will prosecute a police officer. I have prosecuted, 50, 60 police officers for various criminal activities over the years. None for a police-related shooting, however, but certainly for any other kind of criminal offense that you can name almost, we prosecuted police. So I'm a strong believer that no one is above the law. No one can do things that is interpreted as being improper or illegal, and in my opinion, get away with it when one can easily see that this activity is going on. So clearly, if someone is doing something that is illegal and they happen to be a police officer, that individual should be prosecuted for that act. And that includes a police-related shooting, if, in fact, it was an unjustified shooting. And that's the issue right there, is the act that the police officer is doing is justified. If it is, then we have to, as a community and as a public, have to protect that officer. If the officer stretches outside of that and does something that is resulted as to just outright murder, then he should be prosecuted or she should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Okay, Bernie Carter, prosecutor, Lake County, Indiana. Bernie, thank you so much for joining us here today.
No, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And that's all we have for today's show. We hope you enjoyed it. You can catch this as a podcast again by going to lakeshorepublicradio.org. For me, Michael Puente, have a safe and prosperous weekend. Thank you.